This is Crucial Tech, a podcast about technology that affects all of us in a format that allows you to consume it in the time it takes to go to and from the grocery store. I'm your host, Lou Covey, and I probably know more about it than you do. And if I don't, I know someone who does. But first... This episode of Crucial Tech is brought to you by Cyber Protection Magazine. We will attend the ITSA 360 conference in Germany this year as a publication of record, and we are actively seeking sponsors. Want to reach 20,000 people in just a few days? This would be the most cost-effective means. And if you want to know why, listen to today's podcast. Hi, folks. Welcome to Crucial Tech. And today we've got what I call a truly crucial issue. Everybody's been hearing about what's going on with AI, and there are people that are very excited about it, and then there are people who are very upset about it, and then there are the rest of us who don't know what's going on. But the issue is that the rise of generative AI products for commercial use is probably the fastest and most controversial of any technological advance that I've seen in history. Governments are scrambling to understand and regulate its use, and billions are being invested in development. Perhaps as a sign of our collective tech fatigue, however, the consumer interest in the technology has failed as skepticism regarding its safety has increased. Just last month, the perceived leader of large language model platform OpenAI announced its potential bankruptcy in 2024 unless significant new investment is forthcoming. But still, the genie is out of the bottle. And as the saying goes, and there's no putting it back. What is left is figuring out what wishes we can make that won't result in outright disaster. So we brought this panel of experts together. Talk about how we can defend against malicious use of the technology while we mine the developments. So we've got an auspicious panel with us today. You know, rather than just doing my usual interview of one or two people, we got a whole raft of people here. And starting out, we have Hiram Anderson, who is co-author of my favorite book of 2023, Not With a Bug, But With a Sticker, which explains how vulnerable AIs are to corruption and misuse. He's an accomplished data scientist who has done a lot of work with Microsoft and their version of ChatGPT, and he's got a historical understanding of the tech going back decades. Next, we have Haseeb Khan. Hi, Haseeb. The generative AI ambassador and senior artificial intelligence engineer at Google, who believes that getting AI solutions right will overwhelmingly succeed, those that get it wrong are going to fail. And I think we're actually starting to see that in what's going on in the industry. For a practical aspect, I brought in Milan Lazic, who is a senior marketing executive who's been with big technology companies and small technology companies. He's even had a stint doing marketing for women's fashion. But now he's working with a new startup in the security field that isn't AI. He can't tell us about it because it's in stealth, but I'm going to be interested to find out what's going on there. But Milan is a marketing executive, and he has been looking into AI, and he's actually been teaching seminars at Santa Clara University that include the use of AI in marketing practices. So, gentlemen, thank you for joining. So, as I mentioned earlier, as we're getting ready for this, I decided to turn things around and put Milan up first. So, Milan, it's your turn in the barrel. The most visible use of generative AI and the most controversial is the development of content for marketing purposes. Now, you've already taught these classes to communication students on the subject. What are your concerns going forward?
Well, thanks for having me on, Lou. I appreciate it. Let me give it just a real brief background. You've mentioned I've worked in large companies and small companies, and that's absolutely true. Several years ago, I was with a small company where I was handling all things marketing, including content creation. And this was before the recent upsurge in interest in AI. And I was just wondering, couldn't there be some kind of tool that could expedite the creation of content by taking information that already existed rather than having a human have to start from scratch? And I started doing some research and I started to find some tools. And this was well before ChatGPT was around. And so I've become more interested in applying the technology to this particular use case. And yes, you're right. I've been a guest speaker to marketing classes at Santa Clara. And these are marketing classes. And most recently I spoke in, it was in June. And trust me, that's a lot of fun speaking to graduating seniors 3 days before their undergraduate careers end. You never really know where their attention is, but it was a good group. And what I do during the class is we do a live demo of a generative AI use case. I usually ask for somebody to give me a request, something that they need to create. And what I did in June, we did a live demo on using an AI tool to create content for a deliverable that one of the students had in her internship. She was working for a tech company in the Valley. And I said, give me some keywords. Let's see what we can generate. And we were able to generate 1500 words in just a few minutes. And they were very impressed. But then I drilled down on what are the pros and the cons of this approach. And the pros are fairly obvious. It's using an AI tool to create content brings great efficiency because you can do a lot of work in a short amount of time. You can also bring in information that you as a single human might not have. And so that becomes part of your work. It helps in delivering tailored content. So it's very personalized and it's obviously very scalable because you can generate a lot more content. But the cons become very quickly apparent. For one thing, there's the quality of the product, at least the state of the tools as I've used them. The writing is, I'd say it's competent, it's correct, but it might not be compelling writing. And a lot of that is going to depend on the prompt engineer who's involved. So from a marketer's standpoint, you'd say, well, is this product good? And I'm not sure it is always going to be that way. I suspect it will get better over time. But by far the larger questions around this technology are the ethics. And that's privacy, it's data security, it's plagiarism, and any biases in the algorithms. And then another concern I would have is the authenticity. If it's generated by AI, is this really something that was written by, do you have the same connection with it and the same affinity for it as a consumer? If it wasn't fully generated by a human? So it's, this domain is just changing so quickly that, I mean, it's been said about most technologies that the technology arrives well before the protocol and the etiquette. And we only figure out how to use the technology in those with regard to the, we find out very quickly how to do something long before we figure out whether we should do something. And you just, every day you're seeing news about ways that AI is generating content that philosophers would have a lot to say about. I think AI generated books are all over Amazon's bestseller lists, and they're not that good. Authors are complaining about books that are unauthorized under their name being generated and sold on Amazon. Amazon is, as a result, they just announced new rules for their Kindle Direct Publishing forum, requiring people to disclose whether AI was used to generate content or how it was used in generating content. So this is being dealt with, discussed and dealt with in real time. and the answers are not all here yet.
Yeah. And we've run into that problem too here at the magazine, where we have started to get an increasing number of contributed articles that we were surprised at how pedestrian they were. When we asked, they said, "Did you use generative AI to write this?" And they said, "Well, yeah, we did. We thought we'd give it a shot." And it's not acceptable. We've started using AI checkers to if we're concerned that it may be, with some success, but not with complete success, because
right.
just as you're not exactly sure what you're going to get out of a generative AI product, whether it's going to be right or wrong, the same thing happens with the AI checkers, which are basically AIs checking AIs. And
right.
let's bring this over to the source and Haseeb. Google has made significant investment in generative AI, and
this meeting is being recorded.
That's my backup recorder. I forgot to turn that on. Start again. Google has made significant investment in generative AI, and even with some significant missteps with the launch of Bard, it seems to be all on development and commercialization of the platform. And why are you and Google so positive about this technology?
Well, first of all, I should just announce that I'm whatever I say is in an unofficial capacity. This in no way reflects Google's official position for these products, but more on AI. But one of the things that we genuinely have believed in is, or the industry as a whole generally believes in, is safety and ethics. And safety and ethics are incredibly important. So one of the things that was just brought up, just wanted to address that really quickly, which is how do you police something like this? Well, yes, we have AI checkers, but how good are those AI checkers? Are there the correct infrastructural positions, and do you have the correct not just the infrastructure, but do you have the measurement capability to be able to adequately identify all of these things as these systems continue to get better and better? Now, that might be something that may reasonably be addressable by today's technology, but there is a industry-wide understanding that these models are getting better, or large language autoregressive generation models are getting better than the ability for our detectors to be able to detect them generally. So it's a convex optimization problem. So you're constantly optimizing for content that looks more human generated. So if you can a priori mimic human generated content to the T, then there's literally no difference between artificially generated content and human content. And once we're there, GPT-5 comes out, GPT-6 comes out in the next couple of years, then what exactly are we even talking about? And to the earlier point that was made, it's a philosophical discussion, right? Then who is an author? What is an author? How do you even talk about these sorts of things? And how do you measure them? How do you categorize them? If it's the intent that counts, then any number of autoregressive agents are proceeding with the intent of the original owner. So do you provide authorship to the owner that originally created the models or put them out there? What are the security implications of this? These models are capable of producing very large scale code bases very quickly, and they're able to write code, and you can very easily manipulate one of these models to write malicious code. How do we deal with that? Now, these are real problems that are emerging in the industry, and these are real problems that currently I don't think that are being talked about in the media enough, and I think a good amount of attention should be directed towards them.
Okay. Let's go over to my favorite author here, Hiram. Do you think Google's on the right track here?
Yeah, I would say that this concern about responsible use and abuse and misuse, those policies are number one in everybody's minds. In my day job, I actually talk to a lot of large enterprise customers who are thinking deeply about this. I just want to say it's comforting to know that this is on the top of minds of people developing generative AI applications using the foundation model technology written by OpenAI and Cohere and Google and elsewhere. And what we're finding is they're also being very cautious. So they want to have scoped applications of generative models, and they're dipping their toe in the water by first, for example, the applications that they're writing are internal use only, retrieval augmented generation. So can I now chat with my IT help desk instead of searching for things in a search way? Can I have a conversation with it? Now, those are all really good. So long as people just adhere to some very, very basic security policies, like respecting the trust boundaries about these models, not giving them access to the data that you'd want to share publicly. That you should treat these as a developer of these models. You should endow the whatever trust to these models in your application that you would an untrusted user or an unfiltered output and input modules. So yeah, this is the right direction. I'm really optimistic about where things are going to settle to in the long run, because we're all going to realize that this technology shouldn't be unleashed in very generic applications. They should be scoped and used in a way that meets a specific objective. And that, in that respect, there's going to be a lot of, I think, a lot of progress and a lot of good things that come out of this as we sort of co-evolve our security and responsible AI mindset with this development.
Yeah, one of the things that really encouraged me along Google's line is adding the Google it button on Bard.
Exactly.
Because what you get out of ChatGPT and Bard has been well documented as being, well, you're never quite sure what you're going to get. And I think even in your book, Hiram, you pointed out that 50% of all databases used for generative AI have already been corrupted. So you got one chance out of two of getting something wrong. But and I've actually been involved in developing a concept for a book for a publisher who writes books about code or how to code. And they wanted me to come in and rewrite some of their books on how to use generative AI to make your code better. So I got a hold of my son-in-law, who is a coder, been at it for 20 years doing this stuff, and he's been experimenting. And one of the things he experimented with is write me a program to determine the square root of a number. And it came out with the program, and it was just fine. He said, okay, well, but that's one way of doing it. Now, I want you to do it in this way. Yet use this method. I think it was the Babylonian method. And he asked that question, and it came out, and it was the same answer as the answer before, but it wasn't under the Babylonian method. And so, and then he said, give it to me in three different methods. And it gave him three different methods that all had the wrong answer. So we went back to the publisher and it says, well, you know, you can do it. And if it gets the right answer, then you've saved yourself some time. But the problem is, if you are a novice in coding and you don't know what you're looking for, you can have some real problems. So,
but this is a really great point I just want to touch on, and is every new exciting technology comes with things that are great about it, but also come with some hype. And ironically, you know, my co-author Ram Shankar Sivakumar and I had been screaming into the winds 3 years ago about security issues of AI, and submitted our final draft to the publisher 3 weeks before ChatGPT was released.
Wow.
And honestly, we're kind of afraid that nobody would care or hear. If there's one great thing that ChatGPT has done, everybody is now aware not only of the excitement of AI, but also of all the ways it can go wrong. That is a great outcome. There's this thing called automation bias, where humans tend to latch on to automated tools, including AI, and trust them to do things This has been significantly reduced by you and I using tools. Yes, it writes code. It actually writes bad code. Yes, it writes you an essay. It's actually a terrible essay. And those will get better. But in this co-evolvement process, we're learning a healthy amount of skepticism, Google it, and maybe slight mistrust about these technologies in a healthy way. One of my favorite examples that I think is also brilliant pedagogy is a professor recently asked his class to write an essay, and knowing that many would turn to ChatGPT, instead said, here's how you need to do it. Here's the prompt to write the essay. And your actual assignment is to correct the mistakes in the generated essay. Mm-hmm. So first of all, brilliant pedagogy, because take away the cheating option, allow them to use the tool. And second, build in the critical thinking of a human and the mistrust of ChatGPT. I think that those students never again will trust using ChatGPT for an entire essay, right? That kind of awareness, I think, is really key and has been a great outcome of the ChatGPT revolution over the last year.
Okay. I lost my thought. here we go. There's a recent development that came out, it was just announced this week, about the existence of Worm GPT. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard a thing or two about it, but yep. Again, I can't comment on specific other company or our company products. Just gotta keep
it. Okay, it's not really a company's product. It's on the dark web.
Sure.
But the purpose is to create documentation that can be used for social engineering. Create executive emails to impersonate an executive to get people to do things. Is there anything that can be done on this side of the law that can defend against that?
So there's already pre-existing capability a lot of large-scale companies have in terms of being able to detect using a multitude of detectors, i.e. origin of path, network analysis, and other tools that are quite apt at detecting these sorts of things. But the human aspect of this is something that we won't be able to just ignore, i.e. the effect of an email that's written in a very human compelling way. And if you've trained it on enough of that compelling data, then it becomes a very valid tool for social engineering. Other than the standard stuff, which is, initially when those scam emails started coming out, I'm a prince from Nigeria, I would like you to send me some money kind of thing. There were people that fell for that. And then later on, people became a lot more cautious. So now these days, because of education, people are a lot more cautious about that sort of email. I think the strongest link in this would be the human, because if the human beings can themselves look at something and see that it doesn't make sense, it's coming from the wrong address, wrong chain, it might be identifiable, whilst at the same time structuring internal network parameters would be one of those things. But that's not honestly the more important concern from that perspective is the ability to write large-scale exploits and execute them quickly would be more of a concern rather than just generic social engineering, or embedding the ability to embed within large text databases specific malicious code that can then get read up and acquired and be executed on systems. So those are more prominent concerns right now.
Okay. That makes sense. I did a story about one way you can fight against this without technology, and it was a security company, and the small group, but they had five people that had purchase authority.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is every day they have a 15-minute in-person meeting
mm-hmm.
where they determine a code word or phrase
mm-hmm.
to approve purchases.
Right.
And
right.
if you don't have that code word, you send an email to someone and you don't use the code word, mm-hmm. then nothing gets done. And that in itself is a non-technology approach to defending against social engineering using AI.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's that. There's with the whole advent of decentralized financial networks and being able to check cross hashes across a decentralized network and balance those equations out. There's plenty of ways, if this becomes a problem, that it can be addressed, at least for official communications between organizations and official communications between salespeople and people trying to sell or contracts stuff of that sort. So I wouldn't really be too concerned about that aspect. Albeit we might experience some level of attrition initially, because as threats, we're more of a reactive society. We've turned into that, and I keep bringing that term up. It's like we see the problem, we feel it, and then we're like, we need to do something about it. But from my end of the spectrum, we were trying our level best to presuppose and preempt things that can go awry, and I think we're doing a reasonably good job at it. But I did want to quickly reiterate to the education conversation, and that's a point that was just brought up today on my LinkedIn feed, and I found it fascinating. And because that was my own experience, which is that being able to write clearly and compellingly as a student helped me structure my own thoughts and thought processes. And I feel like if students end up using these writing tools, which they probably will, it deters their own ability to think through and structure thought in the same way that writing would teach you. Now, this might be a very past-centric, ignorant opinion, because in the future, who knows, for all we know, we could have brain implants that, you know, the whole Neo and the Matrix thing where you have something plugged into your head and you wake up and you're like, I know Kung Fu. So then the whole purpose of structuring thought is like, okay, well, I need a new logic board inside me or a logic system in me, and you just get it. And that's exciting in and of its own right. But as of right now, yes, that's a concerning motive there. And I don't know how we would address it or how universities are working to specifically address those concerns and actually address them in a way that is reasonably policeable and discernible. I hope that we can do a panel about that at some point and maybe talk about it.
Well, but, yeah. That sounds like a good idea. I've got a few academics that I think I'd like to get on board here. Yeah. I think we should jump to some questions here. We've got a couple of them that came in early, and I'm going to throw them out to everyone. But Mylon, you actually kind of addressed this earlier. According to a recent Gartner survey, most companies are in the investigational stages of AI. If your company is in the investigational stage, what are the top three things you should focus on security-wise first?
I had a conversation about 2-3 weeks ago with someone at a large company, I'll just say, you know, north of $5 billion in revenue, and we were discussing the use of AI, and he said that his employer forbids the use of ChatGPT. I'm always curious about why. Well, their reason was they didn't want any of their own IP being exposed to large language models. Okay, fine, I understand that. So that was at least their concern. But I don't know what all the concerns would be. I think what it's interesting when I read about this topic or I talk to people about this topic, I wonder, well, do you not see you need to find a path to coexisting with this technology. And if it's simply protecting your IP, Haseeb's points I agree with entirely. You're going to discover pitfalls. So now we have to figure out how do we walk around those pitfalls. And that's what companies need to do. And I think the ones that I've spoken to who unilaterally forbid it are doing themselves a disservice. The range of security, back to the original question, the range of where the security, the potential breaches are, I'm sure that's a longer discussion and I've just come up with one. I think the larger issue is find a way to coexist with the technology because it will make you more productive if you can find the appropriate path.
I have a few really maybe specific suggestions for people adopting either a tool like ChatGPT or using API servers to develop their own. The first is you need to develop an AI risk management framework for yourself. What that means is that you have you're thinking about policies, you're adopting a culture because things will happen that AI will expose risks to you, and you need a process to use that. So that's number one. That's not a checkbox. That's a repeat, rinse and repeat regularly how we're managing risk the organization. Mm-hmm. Number two thing, if you're doing this, I would start simple. Use an on-prem or your own cloud service so that data is not leaving your organizational cloud. So that already cuts off a lot of the bad security things that can happen. Second thing, disable plugins and extensions to these services for now, while you're figuring out your policy. That will just, that's just playing it safe. And finally, when you're ready to open those up, look at various solutions for data loss prevention, DLP, or other kind of firewall things that you can put in place as you're wanting to open up these capabilities later. So that'd be four specific things to look at.
Okay, Jose, what did you want to say about that?
Yeah, so I just wanted to quickly touch base on what was just being said. So yes, on-prem clouds are one solution, but I just wanted to correct a little misconception that I've seen a bunch of people ask me. So there's one very particular point. The way Google has structured our internal or external corporate offerings is if you decide to use, let's say, a Google-based model on our Vertex AI system or any of our internal systems. And I know I wasn't going to comment on specific products, but I just need to make a clarification here. If you're using the Palm 340B or any of the larger models or even the smaller models, we do not use that data to uptrain the base model. That model that you are using is being run in a subtenant of the customer that is sealed off. And the way currently GCP sets that up is with CMEC keys. So customer managed encryption keys is one thing that you can sign up for, which means that any query going in and out of that model does not modify the base model. That a version of that base model is being run in that tenant. Other people do not have access to the model. Other people do not have access to the data being piped in and out of that model. And there's a bunch of SLA level guarantees that go around it, which Google can provide, which are what we call end-chain verifiable, i.e. from the point the data enters our cloud to the point where it leaves the cloud, at every single point of that, where it's being processed, how it's being processed, which specific accelerator it's being processed on, where that accelerator is located, where the data is being located, if any copies are being made, everything is verifiable. So, and that is not something that Google does specifically for generative AI. It was company policy to do that and keep those data safeguards there very, very specifically. So just wanted to clarify that because it's a question that I've been hearing from a lot of people. And so you're just using your platform to shout that out, being like, no, that doesn't happen that way. Other people, I can't comment on whether they do it or not do it. I know for a fact we don't do it. So.
That actually brings in something that I had heard about recently, and I'm thinking about doing some articles on. The interesting thing about generative AI is it's created all kinds of other industries, like AI checkers, like we talked about earlier. But another industry that's popped up is clean data. Because the biggest problem with, say, ChatGPT and with apologies to Bard, is that it uses all the information in the entire internet, regardless of the quality of it. Whereas if you're going to create a large language model for a specific purpose, it really helps to control what data goes in there and to do some fact checking. That's what it sounds like Google is doing.
So let me bifurcate that into two sub questions. One is the actual training data that you use to train the base models, and the other one is the data that's being piped through it. The data that's being piped through it is secure and tangentialized in two ways. One is the customer tenant and having the model run, as I just explained. The other is geographical requirements, because GCP, as you know, is something that spans across the globe. There are actual EU countries that I can't go into the details of that mitigate or have specific guidelines about people's data or PII, any kind of that sort of data, leaving that country's geographical boundaries or a region's geographical boundaries. So all accelerated processing, storage of that data must happen within specific geographical or GDPR boundaries. And then we have to assure that that happens that way. And there's actual Google products that have been doing that. And that also applies to our generative AI offerings as well as our regular AI offerings. But to the other point about the uptraining data, we don't use the entire internet's data to train the model. Although plugins might have access to the entirety of the internet data to be able to Google them or use Google, and that happens for a multitude of AI models, but we don't. So, but the thing is, in the corpus of data, if there is inaccuracies, you're absolutely right. Those inaccuracies will get reflected in the model's outputs. I'm not sure if those inaccuracies are the result of corrupted data or if the model itself is hallucinating, which it very well could be because of the nature of autoregressive agents. And then that's the same case for other models, ChatGPT being one of them. So we don't know where that threshold is, whether the inaccuracy is specifically being caused by the model hallucinating versus inaccuracy in the training data. It's entirely possible that if you go and look at the training data is fine, but the model hallucinates just because of the very nature of autoregressive agents. Because as much as we'd like to think about these as very artificially intelligent systems, and one of the panelists can back me up on this, they're technically still the same technology that you use on your cell phone to predict the next word. They're autoregressive text prediction agents that can do some amazing things, but at their core, that's what they are. So they're bound to hallucinate at some point.
Hiram, what do you think?
Yeah, so first, data does matter. The reason that we've used the internet to train these models is because the greatest, easiest source of data. And the models are trained on data sets like the pile. And the pile includes Common Crawl, which is literally the Wayback Machine for the internet that is archived regularly. Like, to a fantastic degree, there's nothing wrong with those data besides the glaring thing that it encodes our biases, our misinformation. There is actually with colleagues at Google Brain, we demonstrated that an attacker could overtake some of these web domains used to train these foundation models and really cause dangers downstream in those models. But there are very, very simple defenses and checks that you can put in place to prevent that from happening. Essentially, it's like when you download a file, verify its hash, like that kind of simple behavior can prevent these poisoning attacks from happening. So I would be reticent to make people scared about using models because they were trained on the internet. More concerned about helping us rein in what is called bias amplification of good data that just represents humanity's, humanity, and sometimes amplifies the more uncouth elements of that.
Okay. One more question. In your opinion, what's the biggest danger from AI that you don't think is getting enough attention? We may have already talked about that.
To me, the biggest the biggest danger we talked about are like the big ideas, and they're going to exist a long time. There's some really important near-term ones that don't get talked about a lot that may go away soon. But this has to do with the democratization of AI in open source repositories where we don't have traditional security practices in place. So what happens today? Organization says, hey, I want to build a thing. And like, I can either pay OpenAI or Microsoft or somebody, or I can go to Hugging Face and download this for free. Let me search around. So what's happening here is there's this supply chain problem that exists in other industries that is magnified in AI because it's not just software. Yes, it inherits all the stuff from software, but there's also the data supply chain that you don't control. And now the model supply chain that you don't control. That's both the weights, how it performs. Usually these are advertised as on kind of a leaderboard mentality, like this is better than this because of this benchmark, but does not at all explore robustness, bias, and fairness are not elements of that leaderboard. So this supply chain thing to me is like, if you want to not think about the unsolvable problems, but the ones that we can fix today, they're right there, supply chain in AI.
Excellent.
Yeah, I can take the second part of that on. And I completely agree with the problems that Haran just pointed out. There are, to me, the biggest problem is that of generated content taking over and turning this into a feedback loop, which is currently most of the content on the internet is human generated. The AI is learning from that human generated content. We're training everything on that data. Zero-shot learning will become a thing. At some point, most of that content then becomes AI-generated. And then you have AI-generated content being fed into AI-generated content to generate more AI-generated content. Not to mention that that then causes this stagnation of, or has the ability, not saying it will, has this ability to cause a stagnation of human endeavor to build stuff. So for instance, if AI-generated art is just as good as human-generated art, and then AI-generated art can be done at mass scale, and why would a human go out and generate art? So post-20th century, all art is AI-generated. There is no giant artistic revolution that happens. And that, I think, to me, personally, that's a huge danger in terms of the endeavor of human knowledge transmutation and how we go about living our lives. And how what this means for the future, I don't think that's very clear to me at this point. And that's something that I do sleep over.
What about you, Mylon?
I think the points Haseeb raised are the ones that will, I think the security we can, the big we, the royal we, will address. But there's again, I'll use the word philosophy. If what do we want AI to do? What will we expect AI to do? Because there is this dilution of AI that Haseeb refers to. You've got AI today, AI generated content is based on what in large part has been created by humans, but ultimately how much of it will be created by humans if humans no longer have to do it? It reminds me of, there was a, you know, those of us who are a little older remember decades ago, you used to be able to buy what were effectively term papers, ostensibly for research. Did anybody ever turn in one of those papers on, you know, as an assignment in university? Well, probably. But it relieved that student of the burden to do any research on his or her own. So then we had the internet. Well, the internet didn't relieve the burden of doing research. It was another tool. You still had to do some thinking for the most part. But is AI then now making it easier to skip over that step? And it's like, okay, I need it on this topic. It needs to address these things. Take this perspective and write me an essay. Well, the internet didn't do that when it arrived in the 90s. AI is now getting closer to that. And you know, I share that concern, and from a purely just in my domain of content marketing, it's one thing for someone to read a white paper or a blog post and for it to have been generated largely by technology with some moderation and oversight by a human. I'm not sure how dangerous that is to all of us, but you can see where go down the road, and it does get more dangerous. I mean, overall and long term, I am optimistic. Hiram has spoken that he's an optimist. I'm sure Haseeb is, or he wouldn't be in the job he is, about AI and what it will do for us. I look at radio didn't kill theater. Television didn't kill radio. The internet didn't kill television. And it didn't kill libraries. We still have them. And people still read and they still think. But then what will be the output of that? I'm not sure we've seen it yet, but it's good that we're talking about these concerns.
I don't think we could have wrapped it up any better, Mylan. So, gentlemen, thank you for your time and your insights. I really appreciate it. And folks, I want you to remember that the transcript for this discussion will be in the next special issue of Cyber Protection Magazine. That will be distributed October 10th through 12th at the ITSA 365 Expo and Conference in Nuremberg, Germany. And after that, it will be available online at cyberprotectionmagazine.com. If you have any questions or concerns or comments, drop us a line at cyberprotectionmagazine.com. We'll get back to you. We may even make you a star. So thanks for listening. This has been a Footwasher Media production.